Hello.
Thanks for coming in out in the sunshine, foregoing the naps. I think pretty much all of you have turned to be here to read some poetry together. So this workshop came out of my own sense of alarm about the state of the world, to be quite frank with you. And also my awareness that there is some really tremendous writing being done about the state of the world. And so what I've done is sort of curate a small group of poems that represent some of the voices that I think are really remarkable. Primarily what I brought is going to focus on the issue of well, I think the term that will encompass a lot of things, including economic injustice and institutionalized racism, but the whole Black Lives Matter, that idea is what's sort of the governing idea behind the choice of poems that I brought in. It's not exclusively that, but you'll see that many of the poems are written by Black writers who are writing directly into those societal dilemmas. So I wanted to start just with a little framing of what we're going to be doing. And essentially what I'm going to do is I'm either going to project the poem, or I'll project the poem and we'll hear the author read it. Sometimes I'll be the one reading it if I couldn't find audio of the author. But where I was able to find audio, I wanted you to hear it in the poet's voice. And then I'm hoping that we'll just, after each poem, we'll just have a conversation. And I'll try to keep an eye on time so we get to hear all of them. I did include one poem of my own because I think that's one of the important things about my being here, is that I'm here as a working artist and I'm struggling with finding voice for some of these issues as well, so brought one of my own poems. And while I'm thinking of, I wanted to mention I have two books that I'd be happy to lend for the next couple days if anybody wants them. This is a brand new book called Poetry and Protest. And one of the authors whose work will read, Tim Siebels, was a mentor of mine. His work is featured here, but this is going to give you a really good sense of some of the writers at work today. This is all Black writers, and it's a beautiful compilation of both art and poetry. It's a terrific resource. And then the other, I had piled up like 15 books to bring to Holden, and then I thought about getting to them to Holden. Most of them out. So this book was small and light, but this is another just remarkable book. It's Dennis Smith, who is one of the most powerful voices, I think, right now, writing out of the Black Lives Movement. Dennis is also gay, and there's still a lot of stigma attached to being gay in the Black community, and so he's writing out of that sort of double difference, and he's a phenomenal writer. So I have his book, and I'm happy to lend it.
What is that one called?
This one is called Insert, and insert is in brackets, Insert Boy, Dennis Smith. And he's the one who wrote, this is an excerpt from a poem we're going to look at a little bit later in the hour. Paradise is a world where everything is a sanctuary and nothing is a gun. Mm-hmm. And you know, my hope is that this will be just, I hope I've made this clear, really informal back and forth. I'm not a lecturer, so my thought is just to present you with some things and for us to have a conversation. But I did want to throw out some terms just to kind of get us thinking. I've titled this Poems of Protest and Hope. So one of the online dictionaries I consulted said that a protest poem, it said that protest means objection, complaint, or revolt. Protest poems or protest literature refers to works that address real socio-political issues and express objection against them. I couldn't help but noticing that this word is sometimes in dispute. Who gets to decide what is a real socio-political issue? And that's part of the reason why I wanted to bring in predominantly poems by writers of color. Because part of what they are protesting is that issues that are real in their lives and their communities have often been designated as not real by the powers that be. And there are many definitions of hope, but this one seemed relevant. Hope, the feeling that something desired can be had or will happen. And then it also seemed important to talk about these two ideas, because one of the risks for the poet seeking to write a protest poem is that it's easier to editorialize or to make propaganda than it is to make art. And of course, art is a subjective assessment, but I thought it might be helpful to have some definitions out there. So when we talk about propaganda, we're talking about information, especially of a biased or misleading nature, used to promote or publicize a particular political cause or point of view. And again, I'm sure you can see that one person's protest poem might be another person's propaganda, that these are subjective assessments. And it can be an opportunity to stop and think about the lens that we're making that assessment through. And then when we talk about editorializing, we're talking about making comments or expressing opinions rather than just reporting the news. But in art, when we talk about editorializing, we are we're failing to make art in that when you editorialize in a work of art or in a poem, you are telling the audience how to feel. You are limiting the experience to your point of view. And as I hope you'll see with the poems, poets use imagery, they use the senses, they use the music of the language to go beyond editorializing, to engage our emotions, our imaginations, our bodies, to participate in meaning making in the poem. Any questions about any of those things, comments, rebuttals? So I want to start with, and pretty much all the examples. I also had about 50 poems I wanted to bring you, but I did have to whittle it down. I decided to go with all contemporary poems. So these are all of them written, with one exception, they're all written within the last 10 or 15 years. Many of them published within the last couple of years. Many of the contemporary protest poems that we're going to look at are calling out the status quo. They're naming it. They're giving witness to it. The first one I want to read for you is by a writer named Lina Khalaf-Tufaha, who is a Muslim American living in Seattle, Palestinian and Jordanian heritage. And this is a poem that was recently published online in something called the Seattle Review of Books. I don't have audio of Lina reading it, which I wish I did, because she has a beautiful, rich voice, and she would pronounce the Arabic in the poem correctly, and I will do my best. Does anybody have any Arabic in the room? All right. Well, you're going to be stuck with my interpretation. Yeah.
I'm kind of a right brain type individual, but could you define what you mean what a poem is?
So I'm going to give you my favorite definition of a poem. Poets love to carry around and trade definition of poems, but my favorite definition comes from the poet Marie Howe, H-O-W-E. She says, "Poetry is a cup of language to hold what can't be said." But on a more practical level, because you introduced your question by saying I'm a right-brain person, so on a practical level, poetry is language that is condensed, that moves mostly through image, through metaphor. And you will see that in these poems, you don't have the kind of linking information that you might get in a short story or a piece of fiction. The poem is going to make leaps. And if we have time with the shorter poems, I think what I'll do is maybe read them twice. Because with the poem, we don't know where the poem is going. And when the poem starts, we don't even know what world we're in. And so as we listen to the poem, we're following what the signals that the poet has given us. And we're navigating it as we go. And by hearing a poem again a second time right away, we have the benefit of knowing where the poem went, or some sense of where the poem went. Right? So should we do that? Let's hear. Some of them are longer. We won't have that opportunity. But I think that's useful. The other thing I love about telling you you're going to hear a poem twice is I hope that it serves to reduce the anxiety, right? Yeah. And also, you know, there's no test, there's no quiz, I'm not giving out grades. So whatever residual school anxiety you have about poetry, you can just let that waft off you, because this is really about having an experience. Okay, so this is Lena Khalaf Tufaha, a poem as in. On the plane, I whisper the travel prayer more softly. I mouth the words, but keep the breath carefully concealed in my throat, worried I don't have a permit for these verses in international airspace. The prayer is filled with soft sounds, ashhadu, a tender hush, unlike the sharp hiss of testify. And the mess of vowels, la ilaha illa, wants breath. It is difficult to keep all this inside. It is difficult to keep this all inside. It is difficult to pray, and even more difficult to marvel or to rage. Allah was my go-to word for all the moments of the day, the wonders, as in, close your eyes and savor here. Allah, can you believe the fragrance of this garden, the colors of this sunset? How is it your lips are still as sweet as the first time? And the transgressions, as in, clench your fists and tremble here. Allahu Akbar, please help me survive this. Please help me believe this will end. Please help me trust there is some power greater than all this suffering. As in, by Lena Khalaf Tufaha. On the plane, I whisper the travel prayer more softly. I mouth the words, but keep the breath carefully concealed in my throat, worried I don't have a permit for these verses in international airspace. The prayer is filled with soft sounds, ashhadu, a tender hush, unlike the sharp hiss of testify. And the mess of vowels, la ilaha illa, wants breath. It is difficult to keep this all inside. It is difficult to pray, and even more difficult to marvel or to rage. Allah was my go-to word for all the moments of the day, the wonders, as in, close your eyes and savor here. Allah, can you believe the fragrance of this gardenia, the colors of this sunset? How is it your lips are still as sweet as the first time? And the transgressions, as in, clench your fists and tremble here. Allahu Akbar, please help me survive this. Please help me believe this will end. Please help me trust there is some power greater than all this suffering. I would like to start a conversation about a poem by asking, what resonates with you? What do you find yourself responding to? What strikes you?
I mean, I guess I should have raised my hand. I do have a little bit of Arabic experience. I just don't pronounce very well, so I don't have to get roped into reading anything. But I kept focusing. Ashhadu la ilaha illallahi is the prayer. I testify that there is no God but God.
Ah.
And so
that's where the testify comes from.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so that's like, for all Muslims, that's one of the seven pillars, is that testification, that I testify that there is no God but Allah, and that Muhammad is the prophet of God.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating too, because like all Muslims use it, but that's what's written on the ISIS flag in Arabic across the top. So they've co-opted it, but it's something that
wow.
all Muslims testify, and it's one of the pillars of their faith. So it's interesting how she's struggling with that as well, because some people might hear that and think she's a part of ISIS,
yeah.
but it's something that is the very core of, it's like the Apostles' Creed for us.
Mm. Oh, thank you so much for that insight. I really appreciate it. layer to the poem. Thank you.
Well, it's interesting terms of phrase I've never seen before, like, why would you get an international permit to do read or compose verse in your poem? Interesting way of saying it. Catches your eye.
Yeah, and you understand what she's getting at there,
yeah.
Right? That she, this is a prayer she would like to be able to say aloud. Right, she's not safe.
Yeah.
And there, it's what's interesting to me about that way of opening the poem is that it's almost funny. Because as you say, we don't normally think of needing a permit to say something in an airplane. But we know it's not funny because we understand what the stakes are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I was going to comment on that idea that language is taken from people.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was even more pronounced by this person's explanation. Because not only has it been taken from, I mean, it's been from all these different angles, you know.
Yeah.
The other thing that first and second paragraph does for me is thinking about not only the language that she can't use out loud, but how that judgment, based on how someone looks, perhaps, and how she's judging how she is in the world, that go down, keep going down. Not me, sorry, going
go back up.
Where you were, what I wanted to comment on is that it's even more difficult to marvel or to rage.
Mm.
And the privilege that I have to react to my world in joy or in anger and not be judged by the way I look or what's going to happen next because of the people that I am.
Right. But it's not just this prayer that's been taken from her, it's also Allah used to express wonder, awe, but also to express frustration, rage.
Yeah, just to be. To be.
Have her fully expression.
Engaged with the world.
Yeah.
And she's speaking about prayer through the lens of prayer, but also just fully engaged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This word, by the way, is gardenia. I think I said garden the first time, but it's gardenia. Something funny about the display.
I was really touched by the beginning image of a woman sitting in a plane trying to contain the fear and the way to bring consolation to herself. And there's breath carefully, and it's difficult to keep this all inside.
Yeah.
And concealed in my throat. I mean, she really gets in, I can almost see her sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to hold it in, but knowing that's the only thing, the only way she's going to feel safe is if she can do this as quietly as possible.
And it's a great example of a line in a poem that has multiple meanings, because we understand that on one level she's saying it's difficult to keep this prayer inside,
mm-hmm.
but you know that she also is saying it's difficult to keep this all, like this all, inside.
Yeah.
And the line functions on both the literal level and also that on that
mm-hmm.
metaphorical level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I wonder how much more the fear might be enhanced by her being a woman in particular society.
I think that's essential in this, is that if she was on a plane leaving from Jordan, she could probably say that prayer out loud and she would probably be hearing it all around her. I think you bring up a good point that what's implied in the poem is that she is not in a place where it is safe for her to say this prayer out loud. Yeah.
Can I ask him, I was wondering where home was for her. That, you know, that there was a comfort in her own home, wherever that might be, in that day the prayer was trying to be that home no matter where she goes, but she realizes that her home may be a dangerous place in some place other than her physical home, her spiritual.
Move us along. I want to make sure we get to a few different things, unless someone has a burning desire to say something else. All right. So We won't listen to all of this because it's 6.5 minutes, but I do want to just give you a sense of Dennis Smith's voice. So this is a poem, Summer Somewhere. It's an excerpt of it.
These are excerpts from Summer Somewhere. Somewhere, a sun. Below, boys brown and ride, play the dozens and ball, jump in the air and stay there. Boys become new moons, gum dark on all sides, bed bruised blue waters to fly, at least tie, at least spit back a father or two. I won't get started. History is what it is. It knows what it did. Bad dog, bad blood, bad day to be a boy, color of a July well spent. But here, not earth, not heaven, boys can't recall their white shirt turned a ruby gown. Here, there is no language for officer or law, no color to call white. If snow fell, it'd fall black. Please, don't call us dead. Call us alive someplace better. We say our own names when we pray. We go out for sweets and come back. This is how.
And there are other sections. I hope you can see that this poem is available at poetryfoundation.org. If you want to read more of it and hear more of that. So I'm going to have us hear just that first section one more time.
These are excerpts from Summer Somewhere. Somewhere, a sun. Below, boys brown as rye play the dozens and ball, jump in the air and stay there. Boys become new moons, gum dark on all sides, bed bruised blue water to fly, at least high. At least spit back a father or two. I won't get started. History is what it is. It knows what it did. Bad dog, bad blood, bad day to be a boy, color of a July well spent. But here, not earth, not heaven, boys can't recall their white shirt turned a ruby gown. Here, there is no language for officer or law, no color to call white. If snow fell, it'd fall black. Please. Don't call us dead. Call us alive someplace better. We say our own names when we pray. We go out for sweets and come back. This is how we are.
So one of the hallmarks of protest poetry is taking control of the narrative and imagining other events, other ways of framing the scene, and we're going to see this in a few different ways in different poems. It's challenging when we're just hearing a little excerpt, but I think that there are some things in this poem that that give you a sense of what Dennis Smith is doing. First of all, speaking in a vernacular that doesn't. That doesn't amend itself, that doesn't code switch, that doesn't try to write so that we are all comfortable. Right? You're gonna see that all the way through his book, that we are not his intended audience. And so he's not accommodating us, and by us I mean all the white people. And that's one of the things that I think is very exciting about protest poetry right now, is that there is a sense of people speaking on their own behalf and not feeling the need to accommodate cultural expectations that they don't that they're not hemmed in by those cultural expectations.
Elizabeth, would it help us to know where this young man lives?
Why would that help?
That was my first question. I guess I want to know more, because maybe I can have some kind of framework for his experience that I don't have without knowing that.
So in the absence of that, and I'm not trying to be difficult, I'm really trying to, this is one of the core things about poetry, right, is the poems need to work on their own. So in the absence of that information, what do you imagine? Given what you've heard and read, just hearing it twice, and others can answer too, what are there images or things in the poem that give you a sense of who this speaker is, what his context is.
I feel like he lives in a hot, where it's hot.
Where it's hot, okay, great. That's one piece of it, it's hot.
Yeah.
What else?
I think it's a city.
It's a city, okay.
I don't know. It's playing with a bunch of people.
I think it could be anywhere because the experience is one shared by black boys everywhere.
But it's where there's been violence because his white shirt could become a red shroud.
A ruby gown. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, this is one of the ways that poems operate differently than other forms of writing. That image asks us to do some work.
Yeah.
Right? When we see something boys can't recall, their white shirt turned a ruby gown.
Mm.
Hopefully we sort of stop and go, what? What just happened there? A white shirt, how does that become a ruby gown? Oh, perhaps blood.
There's no language for officer.
Right, right. Mm. Somewhere a sun. Below, boys brown as rye play the dozens and ball, jump in the air and stay there. We're in the world of the imagination, right? We're imagining a different reality where the boys playing basketball jump and they become their own planets. Boys become new moons, moons not planets, new moons, gum dark on all sides, beg bruised blue water to fly, at least tide, at least spit back a father or two. So these boys become moons. What does the moon control? The tides of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
What about that phrase, spit back a father or two?
Yeah, I was going, whoa.
Fathers are missing.
Fathers are missing. The image field here is the ocean, right? Think about the Atlantic Ocean. Think about the Middle Passage. Right? Think about how the Atlantic Ocean is full of the bones of people who were taken from Africa and died on the journey.
It's true.
Right. So this is the way an image can bring lots and lots into a poem. Right? It doesn't work like an essay. Can you feel how your brain kind of already hurts?
Mm-hmm.
Poems make demands on us.
I just have to say, you want to sit in the image of boys playing, and as a mom of a black boy, I struggle with this all the time. Where is he? What are we doing? We live in the city, and but yeah, there's this sort of playfulness, and then such tragedy.
Yeah, and the
and then it goes together. And
the poem makes a shift there, at least back a father or two, and then says, I won't get started. History is what it is. It knows what it did. Bad dog, bad blood, bad day to be a boy, color of a July well spent. But here, not earth, not heaven, that place where the boys are these new moons. Boys can't recall their white shirt turned to ruby gown. Here, there is no language for officer or law, no color to call white. If snow fell, it'd fall black. Again, can you feel the muscularity of the imagination here? To say, even if snow fell, it would be different. Please, don't call us dead. And then the poem has shifted again, right? Please, don't call us dead. Call us alive someplace better. We say our own names when we pray. We go out for sweets and come back. I'm seeing a reference to Trayvon Martin there.
Yeah.
Right? You should be able to go out for Skittles and come back. Right? But again, he's not going to say that. He's going to imply it. And to me, this is the difference between propaganda or editorializing. This poem makes demands on our imagination, makes us engage with the poem. It doesn't close down the meaning, the possible meanings. That's the whole function of image in a poem, is to open out multiple meanings. I said I wasn't going to lecture, and then I kind of lapsed in a little bit.
What was the title of the poem again?
The title of this is Summer Somewhere. and I'm trying to remember if this is in this book. I think it is. But obviously you can get it online, and you can hear him reading this whole excerpt.
I think this is on here as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, thank you. There are handouts, which I forgot to hand out, which have these titles. Thank you, Wendy. I don't think it is in this book, but like I said, it's there. We're not going to get to all of the poems that I wanted to do. I'm just going to mention something that I hope that you will check out. This is a longer excerpt, but I want to get to some other poems. So, has anybody heard of the book Citizen? So, Citizen won many major awards in the last couple of years. It's by a writer named Claudia Rankine. And as you can see, it's mostly prose poems. The poems mostly come at you in blocks. And one of the things that Claudia Rankine is dealing with in the book is the kind of everyday, you probably heard the term microaggressions, those moments when someone is otherized in the conversation. It's a fabulous, fabulous book, and it's also dealing with other things as well. But it's one of the, I think, one of the most important poetry books to come out easily in the last 20 years. So Citizen, Claudia Rankine, and that's on the handout that's coming around. I think it makes the most sense when you can take it in chunks, so we're not gonna go there with it. So there was, in the Danielle Smith, there was a reference to Trayvon Martin, but that poem, Somewhere is clearly not only about that. It's about the status quo in general. But then there are poems, protest poems, that are responding to specific incidents. And I want to read you a poem by Lucille Clifton, because she passed away in 2010 and is has been a huge influence on me and also on couple of generations of writers, all kinds of writers, and this is a poem of hers that really altered my sense of what poems could do with politically charged material. I unfortunately was not able to find her reading it, which made me sad because she's a beautiful reader, and there are YouTubes of her reading, so I hope at some point, if you don't know her work, that you'll check it out. Jasper, Texas, 1998, for Jay Bird. I am a man's head punched in the road. I was chosen to speak by the members of my body. The arm, as it pulled away, pointed toward me. The hand opened once and was gone. Why and why and why should I call a white man brother? Who is the human in this place? The thing that is dragged or the dragger? What does my daughter say? The sun is a blister overhead. If I were alive, I could not bear it. The townsfolk sing, "We shall overcome," while hope bleeds slowly from my mouth into the dirt that covers us all. I am done with this dust. I am done. You may remember that Jay Bird is James Bird.
Before you read it again, what is the historical context she's writing into? Like, what's the event?
So James Bird was tied to the back of a truck and dragged to his death in Jasper, Texas,
okay,
in 1998.
For being gay, was it? Or mind it so?
No. I think it was for being black.
Yeah.
It was three white men who dragged him to his death. And this, of course, is the other role that protest poetry plays, is to make sure that we don't forget the death of James Bird. And so Jasper, Texas, 1998, as the title, is important because it's telling us this is responding to an actual factual event. You can look it up. This happened. Jasper, Texas, 1998, for J. Bird. I am a man's head hunched in the road. I was chosen to speak by the members of my body. The arm, as it pulled away, pointed toward me. The hand opened once and was gone. Why and why and why should I call a white man brother? Who is the human in this place? The thing that is dragged or the dragger? What does my daughter say? The sun is a blister overhead. If I were alive, I could not bear it. The townsfolk sing, "We shall overcome," while hope bleeds slowly from my mouth into the dirt that covers us all. I am done with this dust. I am done. Who's speaking in this poem?
That's James Bird.
James. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And can I just say that I'm pretty overcome by the fact that in my own privilege and my own feeling that I was really going to get into Lucille Clifton, that I couldn't hear the words but as if she was speaking it.
Mm.
And I was shocked to see how I revised that to be her voice.
And when did you realize it was not her voice?
Second time you read it. It had to get to, well, you told the story. I didn't need to know the story, but the second time you read it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to deal with that right now.
I think it's, she's writing from the perspective of James Bird, but this poem could have been written by many, many people. Mm-hmm. Many black and brown people,
yeah,
who are dead.
Yeah.
The reference to that he made to the people in town who were singing the protest song and the march. Here's what he is what they were protesting, his circumstance. And I have the feeling that he felt he was representing all those people in the backwoods who are being abused, who never get to sing a protest song, who don't have this grand, well, I'm accomplishing something, who are the victims, and saying, do all those people who are in the protest march, do they really understand how things are?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a huge risk for her to write in his voice from his perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking how much more powerful this is compared to reading a newspaper article about the incident.
Mm.
Because you hear it from his voice. And one of the I was chosen to speak by the members of my body.
That's the part that I am struck by, because it's really the head speaking, right? You know, the body's dismembered, but the arm is laying, pointing back at the head, saying, you know, talk for the rest of us, this is dead. Dismembered body is the voice, and that's horrifying and quite powerful.
But doesn't the members of his body also mean all the others of his race who are also oppressed?
I think when we get to that final line, I am done with this dust, I am done, I think you can raise a question as to whether this is still James Bird's voice or whether this is not also Lucille Clifton's voice. You know, that I could be James Byrd all the way through. It could also be Lucille Clifton. Mm. One of the things that I love about Lucille Clifton's work is that she's able to go here, but she's also able to go to a kind of deep bodily joy that is very hard to accomplish in a poem. And so I hope you'll at least spend a little time on YouTube when you're back, where you have the ability to stream and hear her voice and get a sense of her presence. She was also a deeply spiritual, mystical person. So I hope you'll check her out.
Just one thing that I just thought of. I had heard, after Sandy Hook, I heard a commentary by one of the parents of the children that had died. And one of the things that they heard over and over again were people that saying, oh, I can't imagine, I can't imagine. Mm-hmm. And they really felt that what that did was stopping people from being in that, in her place. Yeah. To actually try to imagine. Mm.
Yeah, so that's a great point.
When my best friend's husband died, I wanted to say to her, I can't imagine. And then I said, I am trying to imagine. And I really tried to imagine what that was for her, and I could be a better companion. Yeah. And I think that's what's really hitting, striking me yeah. about this poetry. Is that it forces us to imagine. We can read the story about James, and we can go, wow, I can't imagine what that would be like. But when you're confronted with having to imagine, then it takes you a different place in your brain.
Mm-hmm. But she says that right there, what does my daughter say? Don't you think that she's asking that same question that you've just said by that one line? What does someone else say about this? I can't imagine what someone else would say. What does my daughter say?
Although I'm reading that as James Byrd saying, what does my daughter say?
Yeah.
Are you reading it differently?
That's what I'm struggling
with. Or
yeah, I just see it as a list of questions, that why and why and why, and then all those questions, and then the bottom part just makes me think, and what questions is my daughter asking?
I mean, it forces us to imagine, okay, and this person has a daughter.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Then it
comes back yeah. to who is the human in this place.
Yeah, totally.
This is not just a dead and dismembered body parts. This is someone who had children, was loved, had other plans for his day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What was your definition of poetry again? Because I was thinking with you, with the trying to imagine, and I think it does the word.
So the Marie Howe definition is
place.
A cup of language to hold what can't be said. Mm-hmm. And I think, thank you for reminding me, I think this is a good example of that, that how is it possible to say something about such a heinous crime. And yet, the poet, the artist, is compelled to say something, mm-hmm. to not be silent in the face of it. And knowing that the poem is the cup that we all can hold, what I love about that metaphor of poetry as a cup of language is that there's that shape of, there's this thing that has a form and a structure, but the vitality is what's inside it. It's what those words hold. What can't be said is contained by the poem.
As the daughter of a black man, I read it as almost there's nothing left to say. And so ending with I am done, it really speaks to the exhaustion. There's just nothing left to say.
Yeah. That's a part of that's well put. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I want to
want to make sure we also get to some poems of hope. This one is going to come in what may seem like an unexpected place. So, can someone remind us who Eric Garner was?
New York. Choke.
Was selling individual cigarettes.
Yeah.
In the course of being arrested, he was asphyxiated, and apparently he said something like 11 times, "I can't breathe," as he was struggling.
Yeah.
So here's a little intro that'll just. 1 year and 3 days ago, Staten Island man Eric Garner told officers, "I can't breathe 11 times while in a chokehold by Officer Daniel Pantaleo," his last words. These words and the protests that followed Garner's death are the backdrop for A Small Needful Fact, a poem by Ross Gay. Much of the press surrounding Garner is focused on the violence of his death, while the poem puts a needed spotlight on his life, Gay said. What the poem, I think, is trying to do is to say, there's this beautiful life, which is both the sorrow and the thing that needs to be loved. So this is, I would argue that this is a kind of a poem where hope is also a form of protest. So we'll hear Ross Gay read it, and I'll put the, I think I need to refresh to get that audio back. Hello.
You're on hold at time now.
Yeah.
I'm going to read you the poem. A Small Needful Fact. A small needful fact is that Eric Garner worked for some time for the Parks and Rec Horticultural Department, which means, perhaps, that with his very large hands, perhaps, in all likelihood, he put gently into the earth some plants which, most likely, some of them, in all likelihood, continue to grow, continue to do what such plants do, like house and feed small and necessary creatures, like being pleasant to touch and smell, like converting sunlight into food, like making it easier for us to breathe. Mm-hmm. A small, meaningful fact is that Eric Garner worked for some time in the Parks and Rec Horticultural Department, which means, perhaps, that with his very large hands, perhaps, in all likelihood, he put gently into the earth some plants which, most likely, some of them, in all likelihood, continue to grow, continue to do what such plants do, like house and feed small and necessary creatures, like being pleasant to touch and smell, like converting sunlight into food, like making it easier for us to breathe.
Mm. Yeah, what an insight.
I found that I kept losing images by words at the end, by the most likely and all likelihood that for me, it blew the image right away out of my head, because seems so unnecessary and contrived.
Yeah, so why does he do that?
Yeah, why does he do that?
I wonder, the question entered my head that I wonder if that's how Eric Garner spoke, or in had those kind of phrases in his conversation. I don't know do we know if the poet knew?
That's a possibility. What's another possibility?
I wonder if it's the way the media speaks and the way legal systems mm-hmm. speak of well, in all likelihood, he was this, or in all likelihood, he was this, or perhaps he was this, and the speculation that goes on. And again, as a mother of a black child, I mean, I think as human beings, we want to blame, or we want to make reason, although we want to make sense of it, and maybe make it about Eric Garner. It's too terrible, especially as a mother, to think that this could happen. And so I think it's wordy, but I feel like sometimes the story or the humanity of people in these stories gets lost because of the word, the silly words that we use in the legal systems.
I kind of took it as him acknowledging that he doesn't know Eric Garner at all.
Yes.
And it kind of plays with the fact part of like what the title is. Even though he's presenting a fact, he's not like taking part of Eric Garner's life and like putting it as like just like, here's the fact, here's what it is. He's like saying perhaps a lot, and in all likelihood, like this is potentially like the way it is, but I'm not gonna like say it straightforward that way.
I think you're spot on. I think that it's a signal of respect to say, I didn't know this man. I learned this detail, and it got me thinking that it's quite possible that things this man planted are still converting CO2 into oxygen. Think about...
I just got it the second time. Actually, because I read it last night or a couple nights ago. I just got it that's what he said is I can't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And that what he's done in his life was it made it possible for us to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is tapping a little bit into something we're going to talk about in the revision class tomorrow. But one of the things I really encourage you to do is if you read a poem and you're like, why did the poet do that? Change whatever it is that you object to, read the poem, and think about what's different, what's missing, what's added, because a good poet has done nothing by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And so something that you may be uncomfortable with or object to and say, that's getting in my way, stop and think, what's the function of that? Yes, I don't like how it keeps me away from the images, but what effect is it having? Right?
Pokes you to wake you up.
Pardon me?
It pokes you to wake you up.
Yeah, I think all these poems have that effect. Yeah.
And just quickly about the likelihood, and maybe this is just because Craig just said that, but for me that really felt like an indication, like, oh, I can actually speculate about, I can try to imagine this man as an alive, vibrant black man creating life, and I think that made me realize how important not just seeing, you know, dead black men, but imagining the life and life-givingness of black men.
Yeah.
You know?
But that's also what this poem is doing, is saying, hey, these people you meet in these news stories, that news story is not the sum total of their life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's part of what's happened.
I kept thinking of it as a line in the new album by the band Cloud Cult.
Mm-hmm.
That says, anybody can give thanks for what they've got, but it takes deep courage to give thanks for what you've lost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I thought when the unabashed gratitude is saying, like, amidst something that's incredibly hard to think about, if the idea is to find hope amidst a tragic loss, then giving thanks for what has been lost is one way to find that hope.
Yeah. This book, by the way, Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, is fantastic. I also have it with me. I recommend it. I want to make sure we get one more poem. There's a particular poem I want to send you out with, and I will just say that the poem of my own that I was going to bring, I'll bring two versions of it to the revision workshop tomorrow. And if you can't come to that and are curious about the poem, I'm happy to show it to you. And just a note for the workshop tomorrow, the description said bring a first draft. If you don't have a first draft but you still want to come, please come. It's not your ticket in the door. So I want to have you hear a poem by Tim Siebels, a poet who's been a huge influence on me, and I just like the idea of this being the poem that you're going out into the rest of your day.
This week at the Sunken Garden Poetry Festival held at Filstead Museum in Farmington, Connecticut.
Oops. PR, you changed your player and it's hard for me to use. I don't want to do it that way. Like, oh, look at that. Me being technical.
There's something happening in the quiet, hot, breathless summer months. Something you notice only if you look beyond the asphalt sidewalks and roads. Poet Tim Siebel's noticed it. He describes it in his poem, Fearless.
Good to see the green world undiscouraged, the green fire bounding back every spring, and beyond the tyranny of thumbs, the weeds, and other co-conspiring green genes, ganging up, breaking in, despite small shears and killmores, ground gougers, seed eaters. Here they come, sudden as graffiti, not there and then there. Naked, unhumble, unrequitedly green, growing as if they would be trees on any unmanned patch of earth, any sidewalk crack, crooning between ties on lonesome railroad tracks, and moss, the shyest green citizen anywhere, dreaming between bricks on the damp side of a shack. Clear a quick swatch of dirt and come back sooner than later to find the green friends moved in. Their pitched tents, the first bright leaves hitched to the sun, new roots tuning subterranean flavors. Chlorophyll setting a feast of light. Is it possible to be so glad? The shoots rising in spite of every plot against them. Every chemical stupidity, every burned field, every better home in a garden, finally overrun by the green world. The green things, the green things, growing green. The mad earth, punishing the green, 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 and sand. Most of the shade of poor from the big pasture. The good ground, pure, sweet. That long silence will never go away.
Fearless, read by the author Tim Siebel. He performed it.
I love the hope of the tenacity of nature that is constantly, no matter what's thrown at it, just keeps coming. Yeah.
And it was in Lovely Norrenals too.
Yeah.
Tenacity.
You know, and as I think we're all aware that poems have their surface subject, which is, you say, the tenacity of the natural world. But I think coming at the end of the poems that we've just been hearing, you can also hear it as a metaphor for the tenacity of
movements, yeah.
Movements, black people, the sense of it's a different way of phrasing, we shall overcome,
mm-hmm.
Right?
I think it might even answer sometimes. You know, I think everybody in this room has said it doesn't really matter what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I can make a difference. The killmores and the ground gougers and seed eaters, they just keep, you know, they're going to be those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Moss, the shyest green season,
mm-hmm.
still making its way.
Well, Well, I love that line, here they come sudden as graffiti, which is another way of expressing protest.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, thank you all so much for coming.
If we have any time.